The Sports Interview with Anne Liguori podcast is brought to you by iBeCool Luxury Athleisure Wear for Men and Women, featuring the exclusive ice-fill cooling technology, along with SPF 50 plus sun protection. Look your best. Protect your skin. Visit ibkul.com to learn more. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. And my guest is Alex Hyde-White, film and television actor, producer, owner of his own production company, TMB, and his own audiobook production company, Punch Audio. Avid golfer, tennis player, all-around sportsman. Welcome to Sports Interview.
Thank you, Annie. How are you?
I'm good. Well, you and I have known each other for years, haven't met at various celebrity golf tournaments, but you told me you're not playing much golf anymore.
Well, you know, the Celebrity Players Tour was so good. And, you know, like I wrote in the book, getting beat by Anne Liguori and Elke Sommer, it kind of, you know, that's a high point for me. So,
you're right. We never beat you.
Yeah. Well, no, it was, we met on that wonderful Celebrity Players Tour, which was really, you know, I got to feel like a pro for a few years. And I play a bit. My boy is finishing up at Auburn. So when I go to visit him, we play. I can still trap the ball and hit it close to the hole. The trouble with me is I'm good if it's an automatic two-putt.
Well, what a great sport to meet people. And in fact, I think maybe the last time, I haven't seen you in a while, but you were at the Frank Sinatra Celebrity Invitational for many years. And that had have been maybe the last time I've seen you. And that's been a couple years now.
Well, it's been several. Yeah. Now, the Sinatra lasted. I mean, Nancy kept it going for us. No, it wasn't. It was Barbara. Barbara kept it going. Yeah. But yeah, we were lucky, you know, like I wrote about in the book, we were lucky to be there when Frank was still there in 96. And then when I competed at Michael Jordan's Skins game in what, 99 and 2000, I actually played for the Barbara Sinatra Children's Center and I won them $50,000 one year, charity money. And so, you know, those experiences, they're great. They're so, so beautiful and so unique and so rare that kind of, you know, just getting back to LA and for the Rancho four ball choose up, it just doesn't quite have the charm that it used to. So now that I'm in Pensacola, I can play a little, there's no 6 hour rounds and they're nice Bermuda greens. So I'm happier out here.
Good for you. Well, we'll get more into your sports life, but I'm really enjoying your book, In the Volume, My Life in Film and TV. And what prompted you, Alex, to put your life in words to share with the world?
You know, one Christmas, Shelley was my lovely wife of 25 years now, said to the boys, Garrick, who you probably met when he was a little boy, he's 30 something now, and my older boy, Jack, she floated the idea of for Christmas, getting one of these things that you ask your father a question a day, and his duty is to write a paragraph about it. Sort of a way of goosing a chronicle, you know? And I said, oh, that's a good idea. And I didn't get it for Christmas, which was fine. I'm used to not getting things for Christmas. And I started the following month. I just started writing. I was up at Sundance. I like to go up to the to Park City every January if I can. And I'm lucky. I got a couple of timeshare weeks that I've had for years. And I just started to fill the vacuum. And then when things started to slow down and people were told to be afraid of breathing air for a couple of years, so everything was shut. And inside, you know, the vacuum created the volume. And so I filled the volume with my stories. And I started as early as I could remember, which was a little ditty about Peter Sellers, I suppose. And I just put them in episodic form. I just had this idea that let me just write little essays, short stories, 3,000 words. And it didn't take long. And before you know it, I had 100 pages. And they go, okay, this is fun. And I didn't have to invent them, Annie, because I lived all of them, you know? I call you Annie all the time, sorry.
That's all right.
I didn't have to invent them because I lived them. And, you know, and like I say, kind of two-thirds of the way, what's the old saw that when the fact becomes myth, you print the myth, you know? Yeah, it was great.
I just love it. I mean, you've really done it all. Film, television, acting, writing, producing, owning And all the while pursuing sports. I mean, did you ever dream of perhaps becoming a professional athlete over becoming a professional actor?
You know, I was a really good baseball player when I was a kid, but I was also good at whatever they were trying to teach us at public school, which in Palm Springs probably wasn't a heck of a lot. And so that combined with my precocious nature and my parents probably wished to get me out of the house, they kicked me ahead a couple of years. And that sort of took sports off the table, except for, of course, golf and tennis. And I played on the Palm Springs High School golf team, which was really quite a team. A couple of guys went to the PGA Tour. Jack Renner has his name on the USGA Hall of Fame as a junior champion alongside Mickelson a few years later. So high quality golf was something I was used to in Palm Springs. And I made the team, even though I was a couple of years younger. You know, fortunately, golf can carry five or six people. And so I was able to letter in golf and then my senior year in tennis as well. So that's as far as I got. I always thought that, gosh, I remember thinking professional athlete was just so far out of reach. And then in mid to late 90s, when I started to play this sort of celebrity golf on a higher level, found myself playing with Michael Jordan, Emmett Smith, Joe Morgan, the late Joe Morgan, Jerry Rice, and then got on this tour. And because of the game of golf that I really started playing when I was younger than everybody else at age 14, 15, 16, I was all of a sudden on an equal playing field with so many world-class athletes. And that never would have happened had I gone the traditional route of try to play that sport, you know. It just shows you two things, that, you know, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans, and that golf is a very humbling sport.
And a great vehicle for business, which I want to get into with you in a second. But did you take to it? It seems like it just kind of came naturally to you, the game of golf.
Yeah, I had a formative summer that I talk about. You know, every memoir should have some sort of bearing one's soul a bit. And I think for the very famous people, when I read these memoirs, like, you know, the fellow from Matt Perry from Friends has his book out, Jennifer Grey and all this, but, you know, they sort of have to own up to their foibles or the things that they had to recover from. I'm not that famous, far from it. And so I took the tack that mine is more of a Forrest Gump journey through 80s and 90s film and television. I was there. And sometimes I was high on the call sheet doing, you know, little movies. Sometimes I was down in the middle of the call sheet doing huge movies. And so when I tell my stories, you know, it's really an oxymoron because the book is all about me, obviously. But I try to make it not about me. I try to make it that I'm a witness to this stuff, that I'm a participant. And, you know, funnily enough, that kind of philosophy translates very well into other things, including the game of golf. The minute you think that you are the master of anything on the golf course, when that ball weighs, what, about an ounce and a quarter? It's going to go where it wants, you know? And the best way to get it is not really to try so hard, just to be in the moment. And so when those moments happened, I was able to meet the challenge. Because of a formative summer when I was 13, a neighbor friend of ours named Howard Montgomery, who was a heck of a golfer, he made me promise. He knew that I was going through this period of life where, you know, people, you know, it's the mid-70s. People were losing their minds over things. And I suppose it's very similar to now in some ways. But anyway, he was my Obi-Wan, okay? He was the guy who just said, hey, look, Punch, if you get in the car at 6 o'clock every morning, we'll drive down to Indio, play 18 holes of golf, and then come back. But you have to do it every day. And I played golf every summer. And it sort of saved me personally in one sense, gave me a direction, and gave me a heck of a good high fade.
You always have to have a good high fade. And I remember you were a very solid player, very impressive player. And you took it to, I think, as high as you possibly could go in that celebrity world, right? But let's go back and talk about you for a second. You were born in England, son of well-known actor Wilfred Hyde White. Tell me what your childhood was like growing up in the business.
Yes. Well, I had an elderly father. He was 56 years old when I was born. And so he would go around on talk shows saying, I have children every 30 years, which, you know, was true because he did have a son when he was 30. And so I learned very early on that, you know, rather like Muhammad Ali used to say, it ain't bragging if you can do it. And so he was very, very funny, very witty, gave this impression that he didn't really care too much what people thought. But inside and sort of in the ropes, you know, he cared very much. He was very deeply kind of insecure and needed the technique that stage taught him at a very early age in order to overcome whatever fear he would have. And so I was influenced by that very early on, the sort of the inner life versus the persona, which we see a lot now, especially in the political arena, which has, you know, become very celebrity kind of speckled with that kind of energy. And it sort of instilled in me the desire to be normal in a way, you know? And my mom was a stage manager, so she liked things to be on cue, you know? And so I was influenced very much. I had a yin and a yang. I had a strong sort of left brain influence from my mom and a very strong and sometimes tempting right brain influence from my dad, who would seem to just get inspiration from most anything and could turn a phrase. And so when I started as a youngster, I was playing, you know, I was a young American actor. And when I got to England, when I was about 24, 25, I was all of a sudden a little bigger fish in a little smaller pond and started getting opportunities. And I had enough of the creative confidence that I'd seen in my dad, but I had a strong backbone that I think I got from my mom, even though she was 29 years younger. At the time, it was really a unique mix. So I think what I learned was that life and the art that we like to call performing is a very slippery slope, you know, and you can't try too hard to make it work, but you also have to know that it's up to the audience, you know, and that's what I learned from watching my dad on stage. The audience will tell you who you are much more than you.
Well, do you look at it as an advantage that you are part of a family that was already in the business as far as your own career is concerned?
Yeah, well, on two levels, yes. Number one is the exposure that being backstage gave us. It's the environment. You know, if you live underwater, then you learn to breathe underwater, kind of, you know, I suppose if you're an amphibian, I don't know, I'm pretending I had an education here. I don't quite know. But, you know, very interesting people, very interesting life. And I think it can either turn people off or it can seductively sort of remain there. And that's what it did for me. I didn't really want to do it until I sort of had an opportunity. And at that point, I thought, hey, wait a minute, this is kind of fun. And that was when I was 19, and I'm not 19 anymore, and I still kind of feel that way. This is fun, and I'm just gonna do it because I'm okay at it, and I'm not that. I mean, I'm okay at a couple of other things, but I'm sure glad I don't have to hit a high fade, or a screaming backhand down the line to make a difference. You know, there's something interpretive about being an actor that I really enjoy.
Well, the people that you know surrounded you were just such compelling personalities, right? I mean, people that your parents knew from the business and that you grew up. I mean, Stephanie Powers called herself Auntie Steph.
Yeah.
Talk a well, she bit was about in fact, some of those personalities.
Well, that was my Obi-Wan, Howard Montgomery. That was Stephanie Powers. His wife was Stephanie's aunt. And so, you know, we knew Stephanie Powers when she was doing The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. and she would babysit us and stuff. You know, the first sort of impressive experience I remember with a true talent, big talent, was Peter Sellers, who was a wonderful mimic. He had the ability to sort of just play very different characters. Rather like Robin Williams, you had the feeling that they were all sort of happening at the same time. And he was absolutely lovely. And that was at a period when my grandfather, who was a sound man, had given me a Panasonic tape recorder as a Christmas present, probably, I don't know, 74 or something like that. I was maybe 72 even. I was probably 13 years old. And I loved this tape recorder. I would listen to cassette music and I would record things. And we were in England and Sellers brought his lovely Austrian girlfriend over for dinner. And my mom cooked a bit of dinner and they all had a nice time. And half an hour later, Sellers calls and says, "Wilfred, what did I say? T.T. Wachtmeister is very angry at me. Did I say something?" He said, "Hang on a minute. Punch had the whole evening recorded. Let me check," you know, because I put the Panasonic tape recorder on record and put it under the sofa. And there's an example. There's a great example of my dad. Of course, I didn't have the whole evening recorded because we all know those Panasonic tapes ran out after about 30 minutes. But you see, that is the story. And I remember that exactly. And so, you know, Sellers was very nice to me, very kind to me, but he too was a very talented man, prone to heartbreak, prone to great struggle. And, you know, I could buy into the idea of having a career as an actor once I got started, but I wanted to try to recognize those emotional milestones, those emotional landmarks, as being toxic, because it wasn't worth it to me to be that vulnerable, to be that so easily sort of broken in the moment. And of course, Sellers died literally of a broken heart when he was probably, I don't know, late 50s and maybe even 60 years old. So danger, you know, the danger lurks when the white hot talent that I had seen at a young age burned so bright that I felt that it left a impact, that it came with a price, you know?
And if anything, I love your gumption about taping the whole conversation and putting it under the cushion.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, my parents were quite happy when I got into Georgetown at age 16 and they said, "Okay, goodbye." I go, "Well, don't you, no, bye-bye." Okay. They were quite happy to see me go. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Pretty Woman. I think the story about your landing the part of the polo playing character in that incredible film starring none other than Julia Roberts and Richard Gere. Talk about the role and then tell us how it affected your life.
The role was a polo playing industrialist, a fellow named David Morse, Ralph Bellamy's son in the script. They ended up changing it to grandson because they just felt that the age difference was too great. Even when I said, actually, my dad's a year older than Ralph Bellamy, they said, "Oh, that's good. But, you know, no, we're going to do this." I'd done a funny part on the Bob Newhart show, which was a classic comedy, playing a fellow named Scooter Drake, a New York socialite with more money than sense. But he had a lot of sense in a sort of idiot savant way, and the sort of Noel Coward blithe way. "I think I'll buy the inn," he'd come up to visit, and Newhart then could scratch away, "I could sell the inn." And so we had an episode about that, and it was great. You know, that was one of those things that I met the occasion, the opportunity there, in the same way that I felt that I'd met the opportunity to play on the Palm Springs High School golf team when I was 14, Coach Mueller had me meet him at Canyon South just to hit a couple of 8-irons. And I swear, Ann, I hit 2 8-irons and they both hung in the air. And he said, "Okay, happy to have you. Practices tomorrow." Now, he had Mike Harmon. He had people. That wasn't going to help him win league, but I would be his sixth man. And he just, the way he accepted me and the way he'd seen me just play, hit those shots, it was enough. And the Newhart people made me feel the same way because they were so good. And I felt is repeated. When you work with really good people, they know you're going to be good because they'll take care of you. And it's not like you're a charity case. You earned your shot. And so the casting people were looking to cast this part. And quite often producers or casting people, they get, you know, very nervous about making the wrong decision. And they knew that Julia was, you know, a star in the making. And they knew that this chemistry with Richard and her was extraordinarily rare. And they knew that Gary Marshall, who was just an old, competent, and not old, he was an old hand in terms of really competent, that by the time they came to cast this part, because they hadn't, they'd been filming for a week. So they reached out, they had me over, they'd seen this tape. Gary says, "Hey, I saw your tape. You were very funny." And then I said a couple of words, just like a couple of eight irons with Coach Mueller. "Hey, Vivian, David Morse, hey, I like your hat. Come see my horse." "Hey, that's good, Alex. I'm going to let you know as soon as I..." It was as easy as that. "Would you dye your hair blonde?" he said. "They got a lot of dark people in the..." Yeah. "I hear you play polo," he said. And as you know, I was a decent golfer and I could ride a horse. And casting director Dory Zuckerman had told him, yeah, he could play polo, because she at least knew me a bit. And so that was it. And if only it were that easy. I had to go through more of a conventional process, which really meant putting a video on tape against a white wall, trying to do the same thing with the casting director. And of course, it just didn't have that spark, didn't have that magic, but it was good enough. And I got in, and the part started a week later. And then I remember when we did the polo scene where I come in bouncing on the horse, getting off the horse, and do that very same scene. "Vivian, David, come see my horse." Julia was great. We sort of, you know, spitballed a bit, improvised a teeny bit. "Well, I don't know, Edward." "No, he's over there. Come on." You see, all of this. They were nervous about it. Laura and Steve, the producers, were nervous.
In the box office hit film Pretty Woman, Alex plays David Morse, the grandson of John Morse, whose company, Edward, played by Richard Gere, wishes to pursue and dismantle. In this short audio clip, you hear character David Morse meeting up with Vivian, played by Julia Roberts, after the contentious business dinner.
"Vivian. Hi, David Morse."
"Excuse me. David.
How are you?"
"I'm okay."
"I thought that was you. I like this hat."
"It's new."
Yeah,
nice. "Thanks.
Come meet my horse, Vivian."
"Well, Edward's waiting for me. I don't want to..."
"Well, come on, he's right here."
"Okay, I'll just for a second, though. I didn't know you were playing today."
We get off the horse, we do the thing, we do the scene. 2-3 minutes later, the scene's over. And there was like this 15-second silence. And then Ellen Schwartz, Gary's first AD, says, "Cut, print, moving on." And it was such a big deal to everybody, except for Gary, me and Julia and the horse. It was fine. We did it. And, you know,
they were so
moment,
nervous.
They were just, you know, because you got to get it right. And you can't do that. Yeah. You can't do that in sport.
Yeah.
You can't do that on a film set or in theater. You can't try to get it right. You can rehearse. You can practice, you know, but even in the World Series, you see a guy, bobble a ball and give the pitcher a fourth out and the game can change on that, you know. It's very real. It's very immediate. And there are consequences for anything, even if you do it right. So, you know, going back to these great personalities, I didn't go into Pretty Woman thinking that I was all this in a bag of chips. You know, I was happy to get it. It was a part that I could play. Obviously, I could play rather easily. I don't think if they hadn't seen me be funny on the sitcom, I don't think I would have had the chance, you know. But the impact it had on my life was that it's one of the best romantic comedies of its time, certainly of the late 80s, 90s. It's kind of one of those things where even if I'm talking to guys on the tennis court, "Oh, yeah, that's my wife's favorite movie." I go, "Yeah, come on, you know you like it too. You don't have to hide." So, you know, I was lucky. And funnily enough, it was a recreation, a bit of the family chemistry, because what brought my father over in 1962, 63, was to play Colonel Pickering in My Fair Lady, which is the retelling of the same George Bernard Shaw Pygmalion, which is Leda and the Swan in Greek mythology. It's, you know, it's the transformation story. And my character, I suppose, would be the Freddy character of the young fella in My Fair Lady. And of course, Richard Gere is the Henry Higgins, and Jason Alexander would be the Pickering, only with a malevolent edge. And anyway, we're getting in the weeds on Pretty Woman, but it was by far, you know, it was by far one of the peaks. If I were a mountain climber, and you wanted to talk, I would tell you that the peaks and the valleys are what I'm happy to tell. Everybody wants to know. But for me, it's those times in between, you know, and I got Pretty Woman. I've got Catch Me If You Can, and I got a little part in Nope. There's these things that are peak moments with River Phoenix in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. But they are those peak moments and are a result of so many things.
Sure.
That happens.
And so much heartbreak.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, I was at a personal appearance at a book signing over the weekend, and you know, they said, "How do you handle the rejection?" And I go, "What? You don't like me?" I mean, you know, I mean, it never ends. I mean, you know, right. so that's I suppose why I didn't want to try to put myself personally in an arena where there was too much. You know,
yeah, sure. Well, because Richard Gere had a house here on the East End of Long Island.
Yeah, he did.
What was it like working with Richard Gere and with Julia Roberts?
Well, you know, Julia was just becoming. She went on to be nominated soon after we finished the film, a few months later, for Steel Magnolias. The industry knew she was going to be a star, but she hadn't quite verified it yet. And this was very much her, you know, blossoming. You literally saw Julia Roberts bloom into this radiant, beautiful figure. And Richard was great because he has this, I guess, a Zen-like quality about him where he really likes just to meet the moment. So if somebody like Julia is bringing him all of this expressive, multifaceted joy, he could amplify it by basically just being there, doing nothing. And he would play little gags on her. There's a famous story about the jewelry box clip, and Julia howled and they kept it in. And Gary, of course, is very much of both. He knows when he's needed to fix something or enhance something, but he hopes he isn't because he really trusts his people. And there was an atmosphere on the set that just was, you know, she could be big, Gary said to me once. And, you know, this was near the end of the movie. He was right. When she dips down in the bubble bath when she has the headphones on with the wonderful old Sony Walkmans, right, which we all had one or two, she dips down singing Prince. And then she comes back up in the shot and sees him looking at her. And that's kind of a moment when they, okay, children, go get a sandwich. In one of those takes, when she dips down, Gary cleared the set. And so she held her breath for 10 seconds. She'd come back up, and the set was totally empty. And they played that outtake at the rap party at the bowling alley. And, you know, Julia brought on that kind of hijinks behavior. She's supremely confident in herself. A lot of actors don't like that. When you listen, can you not improvise or whatever? I mean, yeah, okay. It's, you know, the world will and the business will limit us enough that I like actors who kind of just like great athletes. When I played with Jordan, in a way, you kind of, not so much on the golf course, but in his medium, you felt he could do anything.
Right.
And you felt Julia Roberts could do anything, and that Richard was there to help make it happen and to amplify it just with a very subtle presence. Gary looking over the whole thing, you know, it's like Phil Jackson and the Showtime Lakers. Phil Jackson was a hell of a coach. Why? Because the Lakers won five in a row, whatever it was, you know. Okay, good.
Going back to your golf game, Alex, you've utilized golf as a vehicle for business. And I love the story that you tell in the book about the guy that you played with in a charity tournament in the desert, who came right out and said, "Hey, I want to invest $1 million in a film so that, you know, my daughter can get her start in the business."
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, apparently that happens a lot. But, you know, it happened to me once. And it was kind of like being in Pretty Woman. I mean, if I hadn't been funny in the show before it, I wouldn't got the shot. And maybe if I hadn't had I enjoyed the game of golf. I don't grind too much. And I've said this to my son and to lots of people that, look, it doesn't matter how well you play the game of golf. It matters how you play. Do you grind? Do you have a spare ball in your pocket and pretend you don't, or whatever? I mean, there are all sorts of ways to fiddle. And it's just better. look, if you can just play the ball as it lies and count every time you hit it, except Ralph Terry used to say in the early days of the senior tour, if the ball was moving and you hit it while it was moving, it was okay. You didn't have to count it.
Just ask Phil.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so, there's a great parallel to that. Just play it as it lies, let it come, and good things can happen.
So if you had to do it all over again, knowing as much as you do now and as much detail as you have written about your life, what would you have done differently? Anything?
You know, I would have gone to a drama school. I would have taken that period of accelerated childhood. And maybe instead of just trying to go to a conventional college, I would have tried to, not so much the Juilliard route, but just somewhere where I could go and get a different perspective. My perspective was very thorough, but it was very much the life of an older English stage actor with a mercurial wit and, you know, a stage manager who very much liked cues in the moment, which is fine, but it wasn't enough of either is what it means. And so I went out there and I didn't really believe in myself enough. But I was getting enough work and I was gambling. And so what that meant was that it took me 5 or 6 years. It took me probably almost 10 years to sort of feel that I belonged in a way, you know? And it's almost like getting moved up too quick, or like the boys that used to win Q school. That's why they stopped doing Q school, because they'd come to La Quinta, have 5 good days in a row. But all of a sudden, they got to go out and live in the hotels and get out on the tour. And
or
it was so
if they
different.
Don't win, or if they don't win, Alex, they try to, you know, sign up with the hottest instructor and try to change the game all of a sudden.
Try to change the game, right.
As Padre Carrington recently told me, they should just really play for a couple years.
Yes.
And let it happen before they try to change their whole game.
Well, I wish you told me that, because I would have translated that Padre Carrington without thinking, to my story. Yeah. I wish I could have found a mini tour or two to sort of go and get on stage and just learn where my wit takes me and where my technique takes me. I had to learn on the job, which is great. Small parts in TV shows. And my experiences in England were, you know, very formative and very powerful, but nobody, you know, that's where I learned in a way. England ended up being my summer stock. And by that time I was 25, 26 years old. I wish I had done it as a younger fellow. Anybody who says, you know, I've got a son or whatever, a younger actor, what do? I say, if they're moving to Hollywood, I tell them to take Fountain. But other than that, I say, you know, please find a school or find a theater or find an area that isn't LA or New York where you can develop your craft and find an audience is the answer.
Interesting that you didn't have a chance to do that, you know, certainly with your parents being in the biz. That's fascinating.
Now, I remember them saying it, that they didn't think that drama school mattered because the television of the day was like Starsky and Hutch, and it seemed easy, and it was, but you got to get there. So it was a flaw. I remember them saying that, but I think, you know, they'd had enough of parenting me.
What surprised you the most in all your years pursuing your career? Would you say?
How peak some of those peak moments have been. I just went through a very long-winded answer about when I was younger, I felt like I didn't really deserve it. I didn't quite know where I was. I've been on the set with Steven Spielberg 3 times, spread over, 15 years, 20 years. And the last time was there, it was my 50th birthday. So that was 12, 13 years ago. And it was on the set of Tintin. He comes out. And I say, Steven, hi, because I'd been there for a final wardrobe test. He just turns and in front of everyone says, Alex, Indy, Catch Me If You Can, happy to have you back.
The 2002 film Catch Me If You Can, directed by Steven Spielberg, is based on the autobiography of Frank Abagnale, who claims that before his 19th birthday, he successfully performed cons worth millions of dollars by posing as a Pan Am World Airways pilot, a Georgia doctor, and a Louisiana parish persecutor. In the film, Alex Hyde-White plays divorce lawyer Dick Kesner, a role that was added by Spielberg in order to give star Leonardo DiCaprio an emotional motivation to run away. Chris Walken received an Oscar nomination for his role as Leo's father, Frank Abagnale. Here's Alex Hyde-White.
Mom. Hey, you stay away from me, you hear me? You stay away from me. I don't know who you are, but if you ever come back here again...
Frank, calm down, will you? I'm Dick Kesmer. I want you to leave your things here. Follow me into the next room, okay? They're all waiting for you.
You don't have to be scared. I'm right here, Frank. I'll always be here. But there are laws. Everything in this country has to be legal. So what we need to do is make some decisions. That's what Mr. Kisner is here for.
Well, many times these decisions are left up to the courts, but that can be very expensive, Frank, people fighting over their children.
Nobody's fighting. Look at me, Frank. Nobody's fighting.
Do you understand what we're saying to you, Frank? Your father and I are getting a divorce.
Ne t'inquiète pas, je suis là.
Nothing's going to change. We're still going to see each other.
Stop it, please, Frank. Don't interrupt.
Frank, you don't have to read all of this. Most of it's for your parents. Boring adult business. But this paragraph right here, this is important because it states who you are going to live with after the divorce, whose custody you will be in.
And there's a blank space right here.
El divorce. Qu'est-ce qu'il va penser?
I want you to go into the kitchen, sit at the table, and put a name down. You can take as long as you want, but when you come back into this room, I want to see a name on that line.
Frank, just write down a name. This will all be over. It's going to be okay.
Dad, what name?
Your mother or your father. Just put the name there. It's as simple as that. And don't look so scared. It's not a test. There's no wrong answer.
Stevens, he was like my publicist.
Wow.
He just happened to be a real film fan. And so, you know.
He did his homework.
Yeah. Well, he cast me, God bless him. How high those peaks have been. Pretty Woman, the Spielberg gigs, filming on the deck of the John F. Kennedy and Top Gun for TV, recreating the first Olympics at the Panathenaic Stadium. I mean, you know. And here's the thing, Anne, if I had gone and taken a couple of years at the Louisville Rep or gone up the Pacific Coast to be part of the theater company, it would have been a different trajectory, you know? So be careful what you wish for.
You can't look back, but you can read in the volume, Alex Hyde-White's Life in Film and TV. In Alex's recently released memoir, In the Volume, My Life in Film and TV, Alex regales his 40-year career, the triumphs and failures as an actor. In this clip from the audiobook, he recalls a funny episode from the mid-80s while filming Ishtar in Morocco.
A nice thing happened before we were done in Toronto. Canadian theater owner Garth Drabinsky, a friend of Warren Beatty, held the unofficial premiere of Ishtar at one of his big Criterion cinemas. The film played well and at times was quite stupid funny in a scripted improv way and was very popular with our Actors Camp attendees. Frewer and I actually had a fair amount of screen time, both exterior in Marrakesh and interior in the Casbah and in the CIA surveillance van. New York actress Margaret Colan approached me in the buffet line at Avenue the Stars 3 party after the screening and said, "Alex, you were very funny." After I said, "Thanks, it was fun," she then said, "I'll let you eat." That's kind of it in a Pavlovian nutshell, really. When we are funny, we can eat. Of course, acting in the same frame with Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty, and Charles Grodin at his peak for that matter, while being lensed by Vittorio Storaro with Elaine May, of all people in charge, is a bucket list item. As with the Savoy audition, 6 months before the job, the experience was very intuitive. No thought required, just listen and respond. As Roy would say, NAR, no acting required. One shot in Marrakesh required Frewer and me to be waiting all clandestine-like up against the wall, hoping to trail the hapless duo. They surprise us by coming out the back fire door, and we're busted as there is nowhere to hide. Beatty gives his trademark nonplussed look, while Hoffman kind of jumps in front of me and says something like, "What? Or we're walking here." I freeze, as if I'm not there, and Frewer turned around, face front, flat against the wall, as if he could disappear into it. That was funny. We went again for another take, in which this time Hoffman and Beatty barely notice us and saunter by. Going back for yet another take, I say to Dustin, "Hey, Dustin, you stopped and did a bit with me before. Do you want—" He cut me off, saying with his trademark impish grin, "You had your chance, kid." Okay. Filed away was that one. I had my moment with the Emperor actor. Wondering now if I hadn't gone off script with the "I'm just an actor from Detroit, I don't know how to work a camera" bit with Jackie Gleason on the toy, my very first big screen appearance, to which he stopped the take, putting the short pants on me, as Monty said. If I would have given something to Dustin in that moment, that could have led to improv glory. Nah, no regrets, Punch. Anyway, that's nonsense, of course. Every moment is unique, like a snowflake. Have no regrets. Then again, there's no room for snowflakes when the camera is on. I did get kudos from Chuck Grodin while filming the Stuck in the Van bits in a soundstage at Astoria Studios, Queens. I'd said something before the cut that Elaine liked, and she asked me to do it again, thereby making it official. I can't remember any more than that, except that I said to Grodin, "Sorry, man, didn't mean to overstep," as he'd had the last line. To which he replied, "Hey, good job. It's your tag. She liked it." Upon reflection, as isn't that really what writing one's memoirs is, reflection? I learned then that within small victories can lie big moments.
It has a lot of details in this book, and I highly recommend it for, it's just a fascinating story about the reality of Hollywood and your business, and combining it with your sports, you know, amateur career, which I think it was very healthy, if I may say so. And for any young person to really do sports and whatever they want to pursue, even if it's not, you know, just a career, obviously, to pursue professionally. But I've really enjoyed it, Alex. Do you have any parting words you'd like to share?
Well, you know, Anne, it's nice of you to say. I just want to follow on what you're saying. I did the book. I record a lot of audiobooks. We produce a lot of audiobooks, and we get a lot of motivation. We got a lot of self-help. This great title from Boston, or Rob White, called The Maestro Monologue, about empowering yourself and be wary of the times you've heard no in your life. So these are all very traditional, straightforward, motivational, very powerful books. And I've incorporated that just sort of subconsciously into my Hollywood history, which is in the volume. You know, it's very much about, you know, knowing how to take a fall, knowing you're going to fall, knowing how to take it, hopefully, and then getting back up and doing it, you know? And you've got to make your own destiny no matter what you do. And that combined with sports, like I talk about in the book and like you nicely point out, you know, there's great similarities. And it's not that I'm famous. I don't have to talk about any particular dysfunction or any one job to hang everything on. So I think my story is more of an everyman. It's a Forrest Gump journey through, you know, Hollywood history. And so it's out on audio as well, which makes it an easy listen. Of course, you can't see the pictures, but it was very, very satisfying to have done it. And I hope to be able to talk about it to people not quite as charming as you, but I appreciate your time.
The highs and the lows, and it's really how you get through the lows that really tell all of us more about a person than anything, right, Alex?
Yeah, I think so. It's like, again, it's not so much how well you play, but it's how you play, you know? Does Steven Spielberg remember you? Does Gary Marshall remember you? God bless him. You know, lately the modern incumbent is Jordan Peele, who is this extremely talented actor turned writer, filmmaker, very, very talented guy. And he has me in his orbit. He gave me a nice little part in Nope. And I was in touch. They were in touch with me about a week ago to try to come to a release party for the film on home entertainment. I couldn't do it, but they asked me to send them a couple copies of the book. So, you know, it's nice to be out there, to be in the volume.
In the Volume, which is the name of the book. And the career continues, obviously, so you might have part two of In the Volume that we can look forward to. Alex Hyatt-White, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us on Sports Interview.
You're terrific. Thank you, Anne. God bless.
Thanks so much.
The Sports Interview with Anne Liguori podcast was brought to you by Ivy Cole Luxury Athleisure Wear for Men and Women, featuring the exclusive Icefill cooling technology along with SPF 50 plus sun protection. Look your best. Protect your skin. Visit ibkol.com to learn more.